Okay.
We started with the definition that's the sum over B, the omega AB.
Right.
B. Then we split the B into n parts, like from B0 to B.
Right. Wrote it as a binary number. So the... Why did I do that?
Yeah, so does it mean that, like, first the B is like a string of zeros and ones?
Well, so B is some number between 0 and 2 to the n minus 1. And so we can write it with n bits, right? So that's all I was doing, is I was treating the separate bits of B.
So each
not completely separately, but...
So each of the B, I, are like, is a separate bit.
That's right.
Okay.
So I forget what code I used, but maybe B0 was the most significant bit, the biggest one, and then Bn minus 1 is the least significant bit. And so then the I is the I most significant.
And then we did some stuff and realized that we can write that as a specific kind of a tensor product of those B's, that those
right.
all have a different sums.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
Okay.
Yep. Any other questions? So I got the feedback from the first week of the class, and it seems there's some big picture questions that I never really went into. So I'm going to take a few minutes to cover some of that stuff. Mostly it related to implementations. Basically, kind of question of what the state of the art is and where it's going. There were a couple of questions, of course, on stuff that we have been doing more of later in the class. So that will be in its proper place. But let's see. So implementation state of the art. Well, that depends on the system, of course, that you're talking about. So, for instance, the thing I talked the most about was the ion trap. And the ion trap, so it's a little bit, I'm going to tell you how many qubits have been done in each of these implementations. But that's always kind of a fuzzy thing because there's some dispute about exactly what counts as building a quantum computer of a given size, particularly these small sizes. And, of course, it's always a moving target, and since I tend to do a more abstract theory, I'm not completely up to date on the experiments. But ion traps, I think the largest one so far has really been basically about 8 qubits. Okay? And, let's see, superconductors have done 3 qubits in a couple of different types of superconducting qubits. Let's see, photons, linear optics, about 6 to 8 qubits, depending maybe what you count. NMR is done about 12 qubits. And I think pretty much everything else has done 1 to 2 qubits. I guess there's some probably that haven't even done one, but the ones I talked about, certainly, I think basically all of them have done 2 qubits. I don't remember exactly what I take that back. Depends what you count. Optical lattices has, some combination of many, many qubits and only 1 qubit, depending on how you want to phrase it, or 0. So these at the moment, I would say, are the leading ones, the ones that have done the most. The issue, of course, with all of these is how you scale them up. So NMR is scalable. This is liquid state NMR. So liquid state NMR is scalable in principle, but there doesn't seem to be too much hope for that in practice. So number of qubits. For ion traps, the next step that's really needed to scale it up is to combine ion traps with multiple qubits and microfabricate them and then connect them up using maybe one of the methods I talked about or some other method. So that is basically the biggest obstacle right now to scaling them. Superconductors, it depends. There's lots of different kinds of superconducting qubits, and so it depends on exactly which kind is the issue. For some of them, it's maybe a manufacturing issue. For some, it's connecting up different parts. So for photons linear optics, the main obstacle to scaling them up to bigger things is you need better photon sources. Right now, the methods they use just kind of randomly produce photons, and you just hope you get the right number of photons at the same time. So you need sources which allow you to produce single photons on demand. And also better detectors are kind of useful, although maybe not quite as much of a roadblock at this point. People have made actually very good detectors, but it depends on the wavelength and how much effort you need to build and operate these detectors. Okay, so that gives you maybe some idea of where the current state of the art is. Another question somebody asked this is a very common question actually, related to how long until we see big quantum computers capable of doing the algorithms we talked about last week. That's, of course, always a tricky question to answer. I mean, it requires extrapolating how these things go. And even for the people doing them, that's very, very difficult. When asked by random people when we'll see big quantum computers, I usually say 20 to 30 years on the basis that by then you'll have forgotten what I said. The reality, though, is I've been saying that since the 1990s, so bear that in mind. The main question is how big a quantum computer you insist on to count as a successful quantum computer. I mean, the Hamiltonian simulation type algorithms that you saw in the tutorial, I hope, last Friday, those require only a few qubits to really get a big improvement over classical computation. And, you could start to maybe do some interesting systems there with 100, 200 qubits. And those, if possible, we'll see something that can do that relatively soon, like 10 years or even less if the optical lattices manage to get it working. It could be very, very soon. So for a really big quantum computer that's capable of, Shor's algorithm, we have classical factoring algorithms that are much better than the naive, just try dividing everything into it algorithm. And so actually people can factor quite large numbers of a few hundred bits on classical computers. And classical computers, of course, get faster all the time, so the number of bits they can do increases. But it's only increasing kind of linearly, right? Because even though the computers are increasing exponentially fast in speed, the algorithm is exponentially slow. So, basically they're never going to get to 1,000 bits before something breaks. And we'll have quantum computers before then, probably. But that's a much further future, decades probably, until we get really big quantum computers like that. Yeah?
So quantum computers are currently really slow, right, compared to classical?
Okay, yeah. So this is something I didn't say a whole lot. So it depends a lot on the system that you're looking at. So NMR, pretty slow, like gate times are like milliseconds. Ion trap's a little bit faster, but not a whole lot faster. I think maybe you can do a few microseconds for each gate. Superconductors, photons in your optics, they're pretty fast. They're kind of comparable. They're more like nanosecond time scales. And I mean, there's other things like quantum dots, also nanosecond type time scales. Basically, anything that has a solid state kind of implementation that's a really condensed matter quantum computer is going to be relatively fast, but it's also going to have short decoherence times because there's a lot of stuff around that these things interact with. Whereas the AMO type stuff, like ion traps and NMR, was basically nuclei, right? They're very well isolated, and the energy scales are kind of low. So they don't decohere fast. They last for a long time, but it's also slow to do gates on them. I mean, there are some kind of hybrid things where like you put ions in optical cavities, and then you can use the phonon mode is kind of the slowest thing in the ion trap. And if you use a photon mode instead of a phonon mode, that's substantially faster. So there's a trade-off. So it really depends a lot on the system that you're talking about. But it's very possible that if people build, you know, a big quantum computer out of optical lattices or ion traps, each gate will be much slower than a classical gate. But because you have the possibility of quantum algorithms, you can still do some problems much faster. Yeah?
So currently, if you build a quantum computer, you always need a classical computer to control it, right? Like, if that happened, I need a big classical computer around it to even do any operations.
Yeah.
But do you think that there are ever going to be quantum computers that are completely quantum, or like you're always going to have sort of a classical shell sitting around it controlling it?
That's a little hard to say. So first of all, I mean, for any time for the near future, quantum computers are going to be the expensive exotic hardware, and so you're always going to want a classical computer to control it. Now, it could be that someday quantum computers are so cheap to build, you know, they're just like regular computers, it's just a matter of software. And in that case, it might be that the whole processor is quantum. But of course, you're still going to be classical. So it'll need to have some sort of classical interface to you to, you know, get your input and tell you what the output is. And I imagine, you know, the way companies work, they'll, even if the hardware is the same, they'll sell a version that's quantum and charge extra for it. And so they'll have the non-quantum for the people who don't want that. Today and tomorrow we're going to be talking about quantum error correction and fault tolerance. And I'll tell you the reason, basically, that we think, based on these error correction or fault tolerant protocols, that it should be possible in principle to build a quantum computer. And there's always the possibility of some new physics that will turn up to prevent us. But you know, assuming quantum mechanics is correct, there's no in principle reason that we can't build a quantum computer. And so the real question about whether we actually do build big quantum computers is kind of a trade-off between how difficult it turns out to be in practice, you know, scaling up these or some other kind of implementation, versus what good the algorithms are. Okay? And, you know, I showed you last week some algorithms we know that quantum computers are good at. We know a few more. Actually, we know a lot more, but we know a few more that are kind of interesting. The ones I showed you last week kind of concentrated on the ones that have the most applications or otherwise useful. But, you know, it could be people will discover lots more great quantum algorithms. Or conversely, it could be that people will discover better classical algorithms for some of these same problems, like factoring. Somebody could come up with a efficient classical factoring algorithm. And then, you know, a lot of the crypto money would drain out of quantum computing, and maybe nobody would have enough funding to build a quantum computer. So that's the kind of uncertainty. It's a little bit of a social uncertainty as well as a technical uncertainty there. But one other question was, if we don't build a big quantum computer, is there a point to the field of quantum computation? And I think there is. It's another avenue to give us a better understanding of quantum mechanics, basically. And of course, quantum mechanics is essential to a lot of modern physics. And I mean, you can certainly see this in the field of quantum foundations, those of you who took that class. Before quantum computation came on the scene, quantum foundations was very much an isolated borderline area with very, very few people doing it. And it still is to a certain extent, but it's really gotten reinvigorated by new ideas coming in from the field of quantum information. One thing that's only kind of started to happen is that the field of quantum information has started exporting ideas to other parts of physics. So one of our new faculty members coming in May is Guifré Vidal. And one of the main things he's known for is coming up with a better classical simulation of one-dimensional quantum systems. So there were some pretty good algorithms before. Density matrix renormalization group is one of the main ones. And Guifré's work is to basically improve the DMRG approach to a lot more systems that it couldn't be applied to before. And basically, he was using quantum information ideas to do that. So I think we can see more of that happening in the future. And you know, even if we never actually build a quantum computer, those types of insights are useful. I should also say it's useful for classical computer science as well. So sometimes the quantum computation ideas can help prove things or give you new things to look at in the field of classical computer science and information theory. Okay? So any other big picture questions then? Okay, so then let's start on error correcting codes and see why I think that it should be possible in principle to build quantum computers. So the idea here is, of course, when you talk about any implementation like this and you start to look at it in detail, you'll find that there's lots of problems, right? That nothing works exactly the way you want it to. I mean, when you do a beam splitter in linear optics, well, first of all, the beam splitter might not be, you know, even if you want it to be 50-50, it might not be exactly 50-50, right? There'll be some difference between the reflection and transmission coefficients. More than that, if you don't put in two photons with the exact same spatial wave packet, there'll be some kind of mismatch, and you won't get perfect interference between the two. Okay? And that's something that we can do actually very well. Very good beam splitters are possible. Whereas some of these other systems controlling, you know, even any single qubit gate is rather difficult. And, you know, in some of the best ones of these, people have gotten down to an accuracy of a fraction of a percent, which is pretty good. But if you're doing, you know, Shor's algorithm and you need a million steps or even a billion steps to factor a large number, well, one error in 1,000 gates means that by the time you get through the whole computation, there'll have been, you know, maybe 1,000 or more errors. Right? And it's unlikely that the answer you would get at the end, given that many errors, would be the right one. Okay? So I should say that in classical computers, we don't really have this problem so much. And the reason is that the hardware is sufficiently reliable that the error rates are actually really are low enough that you can do a billion operations without getting a hardware error. Okay? And part of the reason for that is the classical computers are bigger and more robust. And as they get smaller and smaller, actually hardware errors are starting to become more and more of a problem, even in building classical microprocessors. The other reason is just that quantum information is inherently much more sensitive than classical information, because you have to protect not just against bit flip errors, but you also have to preserve your superpositions against things like decoherence. Okay, so in order to build a quantum computer, therefore, we think we're going to need some way of protecting against errors. And there's been various things proposed, but one of the main kind of mechanisms and one of the broadest ones is the idea of a quantum error correcting code and a fault-tolerant protocol. So quantum error correcting code is just, by itself, is just really usable in kind of a communication scenario. So this is frequently abbreviated QECC. And so you have Alice and Bob, as usual. And Alice wants to send qubits to Bob. But there's some noise in the communications channel. It sends qubits, but they don't come out exactly the way Alice sent them. And so in this scenario, Alice and Bob have perfect quantum computers. And so they can do some encoding. So Alice can do some encoding of the qubits. And Bob can do some decoding. They don't have to worry about errors on the sides of this process. But it's only the transmission between Alice and Bob that causes errors. Okay, so they want some way to defeat these errors. Right. So I'm phrasing this as a communications problem. But of course, you can also use it for storage. So in that case, Alice is kind of the past and Bob is the future, right? And so Alice, she can do gates on a short time scale without having to worry about errors. But then if she leaves the qubits for a long time, then something is likely to happen to them. So that's why she wants to use a quantum error correcting code to protect against errors during this this waiting time, the storage time. Okay. Then when she comes back, she can do gates again to find the errors and correct them, assuming she's done an appropriate encoding. Okay. So this is what you can use a pure quantum error correcting code for. They also have, you know, some other kinds of combinatorial applications, constructions of quantum states, stuff like that. But we'll be talking about the error correction application because that's the main one. And then on top of that, to build a big quantum computer, we want to do a fault-tolerant protocol. So I probably won't have too much time to talk about fault tolerance. But the idea of fault tolerance is it's some sort of protocol you add to a quantum error correcting code so that you can do computations even though the gates themselves have errors. Okay. And I'm going to use noise and errors kind of interchangeably when I talk about these things. Okay? Okay? So how are we going to build a quantum error correcting code? Well, the first thing is we could say, well, there's this big theory of classical error correcting codes. And I said classical error correcting codes are not much used when we build classical computers. But actually, they are very heavily used in classical communications, okay? And that's what makes possible, you know, high-speed modems and cell phones and transmissions to satellites in the outer system and to, you know, spacecraft in the outer system and so on, okay? And in fact, you know, CDs and DVDs use error correcting codes. So classical error correcting codes actually are widely used. They're just not used in actually building the computers. Okay, so what's a very simple classical error correcting code to serve as an inspiration for our quantum codes? Well, there's the repetition code. Repetition. So the repetition code is kind of the most obvious thing, the first thing you think of. If you want to protect a zero, you encode it as three zeros. If you want to protect a one, you encode it as three ones. So you see, the idea here is classically, we're going to add some extra bits, add some redundancy to the state, and then if there's an error, we can correct it. So for instance, if we see the state as 0, 1, 0, well, we assume that there's only been one error rather than two errors, and therefore we'll correct it back to 0, 0, 0, right, which is the encoded 0. So the point here is we're assuming a model which might work something like this. We have a probability p of error per gate per bit. P of error per bit. Okay. So if we have three bits, then with probability 1 minus p cubed, there's no error. With probability 3p 1 minus p squared, there's one error. So this factor of 3 is because there's three places this error could be. And once you determine that there's an error there, the probability of having an error in a specific place is p for that place times 1 minus p squared for the other two places. And then similarly, for two errors, the probability is 3p squared 1 minus p. And for three errors, it's p cubed. Okay? And so if we see something like 0, 1, 0, well, that's not consistent with having zero errors or three errors. It is consistent with having one error or two errors. So we could have had one error on the middle bit or two errors on the first and third bits. But if this probability p is small, well, this is much more likely than this, right? Because this is order p, and this is order p squared. Okay? And so we're assuming what will happen is we'll assume that this one is what occurred, and so we'll correct it like this. And so that means if we started out, I mean, so if we send it through the channel and we had either the no error case or the one error case, then we'll be right. Okay, but if we have this case, if we see 0, 1, 0 and was actually two errors, then we'll send it to 0, 0, 0, but that won't be correct. That will be incorrect, right? Because the original state was 1, 1, 1. So we'll get fooled, and we'll be wrong. Okay? But the point of doing this is that the wrong cases happen, well, with 3p squared times 1 minus p plus p cubed. So that's a probability order p squared of getting the wrong answer in the end. Whereas if we hadn't encoded it at all, the probability of getting the wrong answer out, we'd have no way of knowing whether there had been an error or not. And so the probability of getting an error out would be p, exactly. So by doing this encoding, we've improved a probability p of error to something of probability order p squared. And when p is small enough, less than, I guess, a third in this case, that's an improvement. Okay? So usually what happens when we talk about error-correcting codes is we don't do this calculation every time. We just say there's some cutoff, and we'll assume that there's at most, in this case, one error. Okay? And you can make error-correcting codes that will correct more errors, or you can assume that there's, you know, three errors or five errors or whatever. And the point is that having more than that will be some order. So if you assume that there's less than t errors, the probability of having t plus 1 or more errors is something that's order p to the t plus 1. Okay? Yes?
If you just like take more bits, what if you get like shifted over by one or something like that?
Right. So okay. So the errors, yes. So the errors I'm considering for basically for this whole class will be just relatively simple things. We'll talk about kind of more general errors. But if you have like a shift error or something, that's a different kind of error. You can make codes that will correct for that too, but it requires, I mean, kind of similar general principles, but the specifics are going to be different.
So you're assuming that you always know like exactly where you're going to
make a mistake,
like you're not
going to
make a mistake.
Yeah. So I mean, there's various ways you could assure that. I mean, in a lot of systems, you can't really. But you know, if you're sending individual qubits, you could also send kind of bright classical pulses that indicate when you're sending qubits. So if one doesn't arrive, that's actually a slightly different error. It's called an erasure error. But you at least won't get the qubits mixed up with each other. So as it happens, for this particular code, it doesn't really matter if you lose one and get everything shifted, right? Because it's just this translation invariant, right? You have a bunch of zeros. I guess you're thinking of the case where you're sending a sequence.
Yes, so say I send 0, 1, 0, then I get 0, 0, 0, 1, 1, 0, 0, 0. And then if
right.
I take a chunk out of the middle, then like it'll look like something.
Right. If you only lose one, that's not so bad because you can see, you know, 0, 0, 1, 1, 1, 0. You'll be able to figure that one out. But yeah, so that type of thing you have to be careful of. I think one way that people frequently deal with this classically is they just have kind of some extra symbol that indicates kind of the break between blocks. And so you still have to worry about then a shift within the block, but these things help you align and keep things lined up. So if you have a really long message, you don't get totally shifted. There's probably other solutions too, but I actually don't know a whole lot about that type of code. Okay, other questions? Anyway, like I said, the things we talk about for classical, we'll just have to worry about bit flips. For quantum, there's more things we have to worry about, but basically they'll be more or less confined to a single qubit and not kind of propagate to the other. Any other questions? Okay. So then let's talk about quantum codes now. So the first thing, we have this classical repetition code. So maybe let's try to make a quantum version of the repetition code. We'll take our qubit, and we'll make 3 copies of it and send that. Okay? What do you think of that? Here's something. Can't do it. Why not? No cloning theorem, right? So, so immediately we see that there's some problems in generalizing this idea of classical error-correcting code to a quantum error-correcting code. And so the first one is we have this no cloning theorem. And if you think about it a little bit, this seems like actually a very severe problem, because the whole idea of a classical error-correcting code is to add redundancy to the quantum state, right? And if you can't, you know, copy the quantum, sorry, add redundancy to the classical bit that you're trying to protect, and if you can't add redundancy to a qubit, how are you going to protect it against errors? Right? It seems like you might need to do something else altogether, or maybe it's not possible. And if you think about it a little bit more, you'll find more things to worry about. So, for instance, classically, when we did this correction procedure, what did we do? Well, we looked at it, and we decided that the second bit had been flipped. Okay, but looking at a quantum state, that's pretty dangerous, right? Because you'll destroy superpositions. So, the whole point of building the quantum error correcting code is to protect the superpositions as well as other aspects of the state. So we somehow need to avoid that. So we need to measure the errors without collapsing superpositions. Data. Okay. And if somehow we can solve these problems, well, again, bit flips are all we have to worry about classically in this model. But in the quantum case, we certainly have to protect superpositions, right? We have to protect against phase errors, the z errors, right, which take, for instance, 0 plus 1 to 0 minus 1, which is an orthogonal state. And so that's going to make things more difficult. Okay, and that, of course, is not the full range of things that can happen to a qubit. We also have, you know, continuous rotations. Rotations, you know, by arbitrary angles of a single qubit. We have decoherence, you know, which is something that takes pure states to mixed states. How are we going to reverse that? And of course, any CP map is a possible error that could happen to one qubit. Okay, not to mention, you know, if you have a 2-qubit error, that you could have an entangling error or something like that. Okay, so at this point, maybe it seems like a big challenge to build quantum error correcting code. Maybe you might think, looking at this list of problems, that it's not possible at all. Of course, I've already told you that we're going to have 2 lectures about them, so you know that can't be the case. There has to be a solution. But we'll build it up piecemeal. But before I do that, is there questions about this, like the things we're trying to deal with? No? Okay. So to start, let's go back to this classical repetition code. So whatever we do classically, we can also do quantumly, right? So by putting kets around these states, we can imitate the classical repetition code on a quantum computer. And the classical repetition code can protect against bit flip errors. So this quantum version of the classical repetition code should also be able to protect against bit flip errors. So in other words, let's ignore these problems 3 and 4. And see at least if we can make a quantum error correcting code that will protect superpositions of states against bit flip errors. Okay? And we'll assume, as before, that there's just one error occurring. So one bit flip error. Okay? And so what we'll do is we'll use that repetition code. But now we'll do it on superpositions. So if we have a superposition like alpha 0 plus beta 1, well, we know that 0 is going to 3 zeros and 1 is going to 3 ones. So by linearity, this superposition has to go to alpha 0, 0, 0 plus beta 1, 1, 1. Okay? Right. So, how does this not violate the no-cloning theorem? Well, the no-cloning theorem says you can't make three copies of the superposition. So the no-cloning theorem says what you can't make is this. Okay? Which, you know, if you write it out, is alpha cubed 0, 0, 0 plus beta cubed 1, 1, 1. But then it's plus also a lot of other stuff. And this other stuff doesn't appear up here. Okay? So this is what's not allowed, and this is allowed. This, what we're doing here, instead of creating a tensor product of three copies of the initial state, we're making an entangled state. Okay, so that's how we get around the no-cloning theorem. We don't try to copy the whole state. We just copy it in one basis, and then we make an entangled state. Okay? So that's problem one solved. So now what about problem two? Well, in principle, this code should be able to correct bit flip errors. But can we do that without destroying our superposition here? And the answer is, of course, yes, we can. But how is that going to work? So the key is I added a little bit of extra caveat here at the end. We don't want to collapse the superposition in the data. So what we need to do is we need to measure, but not make a complete measurement on the state. We don't want to measure the three bits individually. That would be too much. Instead, we want to just measure it to see what the error is. Okay? And if we find out nothing more than what the error is, we won't collapse the superposition in the data, because that's not involved in the error. So how does that work? Well, so how do we, in this repetition code, let's think a little bit more carefully, how exactly we figure out that there's an error here? Well, it should be that all three bits are the same. Okay? But if we see something like 0, 1, 0, then one of the bits is different. Okay? And the question which bit is different is the same as the question which bit had the error on it. So what we need to do is figure out if one of the bits is different, and if so, which one it is. But we don't want to know the actual values of the bits that we're talking about. Only whether one of them is different and which that bit is. Okay? So in particular, we can break down this question into two smaller questions, which is, are the first two bits the same or different? And are the second and third bits the same or different? Okay? And we can draw a little quantum circuit that will measure that. So here we have our data state, which could be alpha 0, 0, 0 plus beta 1, 1, 1, and might have an error on it. And then we're going to add two ancilla qubits that are going to store the outcomes of these two questions. So the ancillas both start at 0. And so to measure whether the first two qubits are the same or different, we'll do two controlled knots from the first two qubits to the first ancilla qubit. Okay? And see how that works. If they're both the same, so if they're both 0, then nothing happens here. If they're both 1, then this bit gets flipped twice. So it should be 0 if we measure it. First two bits are the same. And if they're different, then we have a 0 and a 1 or a 1 and a 0, and this qubit gets flipped exactly once. And so when we measure it, we'll get a 1. And that tells us the first two bits are different. Okay? And similarly, to find out if the second and third bits are different, we do two controlled knots to the other ancilla qubit. Okay? Okay? And so these two bits of classical information are called the error syndrome, because putting them together, we can figure out what the error is. Right? There's four possible outcomes. 0, 0, 0, 1, 1, 0, 1, 1. So if we have 0, 0, then we see the first two bits are the same and the last two bits are the same. So that means that all three bits are the same and there was no error. Right? Just like classically, we would have decided if we saw all three bits were the same. Of course, you know, it could have been that there was three errors, right, and we're wrong. But again, we're assuming that there was at most one error here. Okay? And each of these other three outcomes will correspond to one particular bit being flipped in the original. So for instance, if we see 0, 1, what does that tell us? It's the last one that was flipped, right? Because the first two are the same, and the second and the third are different. So it must be the third one that's the outlier here that's different. So 0, 1 tells us there's a bit flip in the third bit. And similarly, 1, 0 will tell us there's a bit flip in the first bit. And 1, 1, what does that mean? It means it's the second bit that's different, right? Because the second bit appears in both of these pairs. Okay? So by looking at this error syndrome, we can find out where the bit flip error was. And the critical thing to notice is that this error syndrome tells us nothing at all about what the encoded data was. Right? It doesn't tell us whether we started with a logical 0 or a logical 1, or with some superposition of the two. And that means that measuring this error syndrome is not going to collapse at superposition. Okay? So I guess the last step of the error correcting code is then to take this information and then feed it back to make some correction on the state. And then you'll get back the original state again. Okay? Okay. So that's how we deal with this second problem. We measure the errors and don't measure the data. Okay? Everyone happy with that? Any questions so far? Okay, so let's move on to problem three. How do we correct phase flip errors? Well, let's start by just correcting phase flip errors. We'll forget about the bit flip errors. So we'll assume we have a channel where the only type of error that can occur is a phase flip error. And again, we'll assume that there's at most one phase flip error. So again, we're going to use a 3-qubit code. And the way it works is really it's just the same code as this bit flip code. And the reason we can do that is the Hadamard switches the role of bit flip and phases. Right? So if you have the Hadamard acting on 0, you get plus. And the Hadamard acting on 1, you get minus. And if you do a bit flip on plus, actually, let's do it the other way. If you do a phase flip on plus, so that's a Z error. Well, plus is 0 plus 1, and it becomes 0 minus 1. So that's minus. And Z error acting on minus gives you a plus. Right? So if you're looking in this plus minus basis, which is what you get by rotating by the Hadamard, the phase error acts like a bit flip in that basis. And similarly, the bit flip Well, it takes x plus, sorry, x plus is 0 plus 1 goes to 1 plus 0. So that's just plus again. And x minus, 0 minus 1 goes to 1 minus 0, which is minus minus. So the x error now acts like a phase flip error. Okay, so that's what I mean by the Hadamard switches the role of the bit flip and phase flips. Okay? So what that means is that in order to do this code, to correct phase flip errors, all we have to do is rotate everything to the Hadamard basis. So what we're going to do is we're going to encode 0 as 3 pluses and 1 as 3 minuses. Okay? And then we can just use the same code again. For instance, if we want to draw the error correcting circuit, what we have to do is we Hadamard rotate everything back to the 0, 1 base. So we've had some error occur here, but it's a phase error. We Hadamard rotate, and now it's back to that original code, but with a bit flip error in it, potentially. And so then we do the same circuit. And we can Hadamard rotate back to the original. Actually, the error seems to have been correct. Okay? So it works just the same way as this bit flip code, but in the opposite basis, the Hadamard rotate basis. So the point is that we're encoding in the Hadamard basis. So I didn't draw the encoder circuit, but if you did it, it would involve a Hadamard rotation. When we do the Hadamards here, it switches everything back to the original basis. So if there were no error, then 0 would become 0, 0, 0 again, and 1 would become 1, 1, 1. But if there's been a phase error, well, the Hadamard switches the role of the bit flip and phase error. So the phase error acting here in this plus minus basis just is a bit flip. And then when we do the Hadamard, it is exactly a bit flip. It becomes a bit flip again. So for instance, instead of plus plus plus, we had a phase error, so we had plus minus plus. And the Hadamard will take that to 0, 1, 0. And we'll detect it just like we did a bit flip error before. Okay? Any other questions? Yeah, that's right. So this is fixing just the Z errors so far. So we'll get to other kinds of. So yeah, right. So right, I'm working my way up to step 3, which is just the big flips, where you change it completely. Okay. So let's do that then. So this code only corrects phase errors, whereas that code only corrected bit flip errors. And what we really like is a code that could correct either one. So to do that, we're going to have to add some extra qubits. So in particular, we're going to use 9 qubits. Okay, so the 9-qubit code is basically going to kind of combine this bit flip code and the phase flip code. So in particular, we're going to encode 0 as 3 copies of 0, 0, 0 plus 1, 1, 1. Okay? And the 1 will be 3 copies of 0, 0, 0 minus 1, 1, 1. Okay? So this code, it can certainly correct bit flip errors. And it does so by looking within each set of three. And seeing if one of them is the same or different in the original, in the standard computational basis. Okay? Correcting phase errors is a little more tricky, but what we want to do is we want to compare these three signs. And in the basis states, and certainly in any superposition of those basis states, those three signs should all agree. Okay? But if one of the signs is different, so for instance, if we have plus, minus, plus, then if we can figure that out, we can see that there's been a phase flip error. Yeah.
So what's the problem?
I think before we got the way through with the no pruning theorem, we consider that you make an entangled state. And now you are creating that entangled state three times. How do you? How would you?
No, I'm not. Okay. So maybe I can be more explicit about. So here, let me write this logical zero as a zero with a line over it, and logical one as a one with a line over it. And then if we have a superposition alpha zero plus beta one, then I won't encode it as this plus this, tensor this plus this, tensor this plus this. I'll encode it as alpha logical 0 plus beta logical 1. That's the only thing that's allowed by the linearity of quantum mechanics. That's the only thing that doesn't violate the no-pruning theorem. So what that means is that I have now a 9-qubit really big entangled state. I have alpha times all of this plus beta times all of this.
I'm trying to imagine like how you can realize it physically. Like in this case, you could create this entangled state like in linear optics. It could be possible. I don't know how to figure.
For this, it's probably beyond what you can do in linear optics. But you can write down a circuit that will do it. And the idea is, if you write down a circuit that does this, that a unitary circuit that adds and takes 8 ancillas, 8 extra qubits, and encodes a 0 as this thing and a 1 as this thing, then we'll automatically take this superposition to this because that's forced by linearity. It's a little bit tricky, but not too bad. Let's see. Kind of running low on time here, but maybe I can do it. Let's do it over here. So how do we do this encoding circuit? Well, first let's. I'm gonna save time, and I'm actually gonna use 9 extra qubits. I think. Let's see. Is that gonna? No. Okay. Let's only use 8 extra qubits. So this will be our data bit. Starts out as alpha 0 plus beta 1. And these others will all start out as 0. OK. And first thing I'm going to do is I'm going to take these two bottom sets. So that we'll divide them up into sets of 3 like this. And I'll take these two bottom sets of 3, and I want to create 0, 0, 0 plus 1, 1, 1, okay, independently of what this first qubit is. So how do I do that? Well, if I do a Hadamard over here, then it's 0 plus 1. And then if I do a controlled knot here, this will now be 0, 0, 0 plus 1, 1, 1. Okay? And I'll do that down here too. But now I want to do... If the first qubit is actually 1, then I want these to be 0, 0, 0 minus 1, 1, 1 instead of 0, 0, 0 plus 1, 1, 1. So I can do that by taking this first qubit and doing a conditional phase gate. okay? And so this conditional phase gate does a z if the first qubit is 1. And so that takes these bottom two sets to what we wanted. 0, 0, 0, plus 1, 1 if the logical state is 0. 0, 0, 0, minus 1, 1, 1 if the logical state is 1. But we still have to do the first qubit. So again, actually, we can just do this little circuit. We do the Hadamard transform. If the original state was 0, it'll be 0 plus 1. And then the two controlled knots will take us to the right thing. If the original state here up here was 1, then the Hadamard will take us to 0 minus 1. And these two controlled knots will take us to 0, 0, 0 minus 1, 1, 1. Okay? So this is an encoding circuit for this code. Actually, I think you could have moved these before. You would have had to do controlled NOT gates instead of controlled Z gates. That might be a little simpler. And then you can do all three of these things at once. But this will work too. Okay? So, I know that went by a little fast, but if you work it out, you'll see that this does, in fact, do the encoding for this code. And if you put in a superposition like this, you'll get out this big, horrible, entangled superposition. Okay? Yeah?
Does it give us the ways that are correct
continuous
cases, right?
That's the next step. Right now, we're just focusing on problem three. So, problem three. So we corrected a bit flip error and a phase flip error. And so that's what we needed for problem three. It turns out this actually gives us one other error for free, because if we have a y error, well, a y error is both the bit flip and the phase flip on the same qubit. And for this code, the process of correcting bit flip errors and the process of correcting phase errors were totally independent things. So we could actually correct both the bit flip and the phase error, even if they're on different qubits. But in particular, we can correct them if they're on the same qubit, which is what a y error is. Okay? Separately. So here we have a code that will correct an x error, a y error, a z error on any single qubit. Okay? It's a 9-qubit code. So now, in the last few minutes, let's move to problem 4. Okay? Now, problem 4, we need now to correct an infinite set of possible errors. We want to try to correct all CP maps on a single qubit. And to go from just correcting bit flip errors or just phase errors to correcting bit and phase flip errors, we had to go from 3 qubits to 9 qubits. We didn't have to. That's not the smallest code. But we did have to increase the number of qubits. Does that mean to correct infinitely many qubits, infinitely many errors, we're going to need infinitely many qubits? That would be bad. So let's do something that seems kind of dumb, which is we'll just use this 9-qubit code again. And to correct other kinds of errors, we'll just pretend that it's one of the errors we know how to correct. Okay, that really seems dumb, but let's see what happens when we do that. That will give us some help. So I haven't told you in detail how we do the error correction procedure for this 9-qubit code. I'll say a little bit more about that tomorrow. But basically, it works kind of the same way as for the 3-qubit code. We find an error syncrom that will tell us what kind of error we have. And then we measure the error syncrom. And remember, we have to be careful that the error syncrom doesn't tell us anything about the encoded data. We measure the error syncrom and then correct the error based on that. So suppose, just for the sake of argument, that we have one of these continuous rotation errors. So the error is r theta, which is e to the minus I theta, e to the plus I theta, which is cosine theta times the identity minus I sine theta times z. Right. Okay. So, so suppose we have this error acting on one of the qubits of our 9-qubit code. So we have r theta on the ith qubit acting on our logical, our code word side. So we can write that, of course, using this equation as cosine theta, the identity acting on z on psi, minus I sine theta, z on the ith qubit on psi. Okay? And so we want to see what happens when we just do our old error correction procedure on this. So we know that if we had that I acting on I psi, if we had the state psi, and we did this error correction procedure, well, what we get is we get the state what we get is the state psi, and we add some ancilla that says that there's no error. Okay? And if we had this state, and we acted on it that way, we'd get the state zi, this is before we measure, zi psi, and we'd have an ancilla that says the error is zi. Okay? And by linearity, we have the superposition of these two things. So this error syndrome extraction, again, it's a quantum operation. It has to act linearly. Again, we haven't measured the error syndrome yet. So we have amplitude cos theta for this first thing and amplitude minus I sine theta for the second thing. Okay? And then what happens when we measure the error syndrome? So we're measuring this ancilla register. And these two values are, these two branches have different values for the ancilla register. Right? So when we measure them, they'll decohere, they'll be treated separately. And what happens is with probability cosine squared theta, we get this first option. And so the first option is that we had the state I psi. And the ancilla said no error. And with probability sine squared theta, we had the second option. We had error zi psi. And the ancilla said the error is zi. Okay? So look what's happened here. By doing the old error syndrome procedure, by pretending that the actual error was I, X, Y, or Z, what happens is we've collapsed the state so that we have either the error I, no error, or we have the error Z. Okay? This is really a triumph of wishful thinking. By pretending the error was I, X, Y, or Z, we made it actually true. Okay? This is really the most remarkable thing about quantum error correction and the thing that makes it actually possible to correct general errors. That we can take a superposition of errors and collapse them by measuring what the error is. Okay? So the other thing to notice here is that the collapse is consistent, right? So that when the ancilla tells us there's no error, there actually was no error. And when the ancilla tells us the error is z, the error actually was z. Okay? It doesn't get mixed up between the two. Okay? So then we know what the error is, and then we can correct it. Just like before. Okay? So really what this is saying, this is a much more general property. It's not just restricted to this error. Really what it is a more general theorem that says if quantum error correcting code corrects the errors A and B, then it also, without doing anything else, corrects any superposition of A and B. Okay? And as a corollary, since the most general thing that can happen to a single qubit is going to be a 2x2 matrix, right? I mean, even a CP map will involve each of the Krauss operators will be a 2x2 matrix. The polys I, X, Y, and Z form a basis for the space of 2x2 matrices, right? I, is your density x this y. So these span the space of 2 by 2 matrices. So if you correct I, x, y, and z, then you can correct any linear superposition of them, which means you can correct any 2 by 2 matrix. So a code that corrects I, x, y, and z can correct any single qubit error. Well, so in this particular case, where we're correcting r theta, we only needed two, because we only had I and z. But if you have a more general two-qubit error, you might need all four, right? There's 2 by 2 matrices, so there's four-dimensional vector space, so you need a basis of four elements. Okay? And actually, you can generalize this, right? Because if you take tensor products of I, x, y, and z on t qubits, that spans the space of 2 to the t by 2 to the t matrices. And so correcting I, x, y, and z on t qubits means that you have a code that corrects t qubit errors. Okay. But in particular, this 9-qubit code, since it corrects x, y, and z, and the identity is easy, you don't have to do anything, will correct all single qubit errors. So this 9-qubit code is in our first true quantum error correcting code. Corrects an arbitrary single qubit error, solving problem 4. Okay, so I should stop there. Tomorrow we'll talk more about quantum error correcting codes and a little bit about fault tolerance. I guess I could take a quick question, but probably we should clear the room for the next class soon. So. No? No quick question? OK. Yes?
You can actually correct the general form of error. Is it just, is it trivial or is it?
Well, it's no. So it's not certainly not trivial. So it's a consequence of this theorem. There's a little bit more to it than I said, mostly because for kind of unitary 2 by 2 things, it's more or less trivial as a consequence of this corollary. That I, x, y, and z spans space of 2 by 2 matrices, you can write any unitary this way. Then you also want to correct general CP maps. Right? And so there you have to, the easiest way I think is to use the Krauss representation. And then look each of the, so you get a pure state going to a mixed state. So you have a mixture of different things. But if you look at each of the pure states and the decomposition of that mixed state, it's going to have a 2 by 2 non-unitary matrix applied to the original state. And that's the Krauss operator. And so you apply this to the Krauss operator, and then you get this. So it's not too hard. OK? So let's leave it there.